This episode is made possible by Awin. Unlock unlimited marketing opportunities that reach consumers everywhere using Awin's affiliate partnerships platform. Choose which partners best match your marketing objectives, control your costs by defining how you pay, and customize your affiliate marketing program using Awin's tech to mirror your unique goals, whatever they may be. Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more and get started today. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. I don't know why I'm out of breath. I've done literally nothing the last 10 minutes.
You did just speak at the speed of light, so maybe
is that why?
It.
Okay, let's pretend that's the reason. This is the Friday show that may or may not be stealing coasters from the office. Victoria, anything to say?
I plead the fifth.
That means she did it. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. In-store retail media's impact.
You know, when you think about the sort of size of, and shape of the landscape, there is kind of a different reality for Amazon and Walmart than there is for everyone else.
Will Google eat the internet?
If the internet becomes a sea of bots summarizing content written by other bots, its search product will be unusable. And if consumers don't use its search product, there's no reason for advertisers to keep spending on Google search, and Google loses its cash cow.
Has the rebrand from HBO to Max worked?
They have reduced their losses, but don't be fooled by their PR statements about profitability. Taking down write-downs to make yourself look good for a quarter doesn't mean that you've laid a good foundation for your service.
Is the US ad market starting to see green shoots? And we check in on some interesting facts about the Barbie movie. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. They are all senior analysts and all on digital advertising and media team. We start with Evelyn Mitchell-Wolf, based out of Virginia.
Hello, Marcus. Hey, everyone.
Hello there. We also have with us Ross Benish, based out of just above New York City.
Hey, Marcus.
And finally, we have Max Willins, based out of Pennsylvania.
Yo.
Hey, fella. So we have three segments for you as per usual. We start with the story of the week. We're talking about in-store retail media's impact. We then move to the debate of the week. For today, Make the Case is what it's called, and our panel will present the best arguments they can from each of the three stories we have for you. And then we move to Dinner Party Data, where we talk about some random trivia we've recently learned. We start, of course, with the story of the week. In-store retail media's impact out of 10. What do we think it's going to be? Well, with retail media being an increasingly important focal point for the ad industry, the excitement about the in-store portion of retail media is starting to mount. In-store retail media being signage displays that you would see walking around a retailer's store, ads, if you will. So Insider Intelligence Retail Briefings analyst Rachel Wolf recently wrote about a few investments that major retailers are making in this in-store retail media space. So Canadian grocer Loblaw is adding digital screens to over 500 stores so brands can target shoppers. Vibonomics and Stingray Advertising are combining their networks to offer in-store audio ads across 25,000 grocery, convenience, home improvement, and drug stores. Macy's is also now serving contextually targeted ads to in-store shoppers, and advertisers can already buy placements on 170,000 digital screens across Walmart's nearly 5,000 US stores. But folks, Rachel writes that in-store retail media is rapidly becoming retailers' next area of focus as they look to turn their one major advantage over Amazon, their in-store audiences, into an opportunity to grow ad sales. Max, I'll start with you. What do you think in-store retail media's impact will be slash is out of 10?
I think I'm going to, at the moment, just go for 2. It's obviously an area of immense interest for retailers because, as you point out, a lot of them have been trying to figure out how to wring more value out of their brick and mortar footprints. But if you look at our forecast, the in-store's share of overall retail media ad spending is going to remain quite low. And I think also this is a little harder to sort of prove with data that exists right now. But I think that retailers are going to have to be really, really careful about entering this foray. I mean, I don't know how many people walk around in a grocery store or a mall or a department store and go, you know, this place needs more ads. I need more of that. I would like a display ad in my face while I am trying to pick out avocados. My ears are uncrammed with ads. This is unacceptable. So, you know, they just, and that's something that's, they're going to have to think very deliberately and very carefully about, because one of the reasons that these brick and mortar footprints are such a problem for retailers is because people have stopped going into them. And if they turn the experience of going into them even more unpleasant, it's going to hasten a decline of in-store traffic that I think should be of an immense concern to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fully agree on that kind of slippery slope issue that in-store retail media presents. Has anyone seen Minority Report here?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a future we could easily find ourselves in. I mean, not so much the like eyeball situation that they use to, for you scan the eyeball and then that's like your consumer profile and it follows you around the store. Hopefully that we don't reach that territory, but
we will.
But yeah, I mean, it's easy to see how in-store experience surrounded by inescapable ads would be horrible for everyone except for those that are making money. And I wonder, though, Max, to your point about the percentage of ad dollars, retail media ad dollars that in-store will account for being so low, I wonder if that's because of the sheer magnitude of Amazon. If we took Amazon out of the equation, I bet in-store would be pretty significant. So I think, you know, to Marcus's point, it is one of the only big advantages that the long tail of retail media players have over Amazon. So it's definitely worthy of a focus to try and kind of grow the pie in the favor of Amazon's competitors.
It's a good point. But I would also say, too, that the flip of that is that you then have to worry about misalignment, because you think about something mm-hmm. like a Stingray or Vibenomics or something like a Citrus ad, and a lot of the long tail retailers that are hoping to, you know, generate some extra coin via retail media are going to have to rely on aggregators. And the incentives of an aggregator and the supply that they are aggregating are, you know, in theory should be very tight and there should be a lot of good alignment there, but there isn't always. And so I think that that's another reason why if you're, you know, a mid-sized grocery chain or an electronics retailer that, you know, owns a couple dozen stores, you have to be really careful about, you know, just signing a contract and importing a bunch of tech into your stores. And you have to feel rock solid that, you know, the experience that they're going to bring into your environments is going to be what you want. So
mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely.
That's just my empty sense.
Definitely worth caution for sure.
Yeah. Well, so Max, you're a 2 out of 10 at the moment, but you think in-store retail media can get to a what?
It's a great question. I mean, I think Evelyn's point is absolutely fair that, you know, when you think about the sort of size of, and shape of the landscape, there is kind of a different reality for Amazon and Walmart than there is for everyone else. So mm-hmm. I guess it could get to a 4, but I think that this is principally a digitally driven channel. So,
okay.
You know, even with the growth, it's never going to be more than 4, I would think.
Evelyn, you said, where do you think it is today and where can it get to?
Yeah, I forgot to answer that part of your question. I'm generally in line with Max. I think maybe 5 or 6 is where it would top out. Maybe I'm just optimistic, putting too much trust in the hands of retailers to do it right. But yeah, right now I'd say it definitely sits at a 2, but it's got a lot of potential.
Ross?
I put it at a 5. What it has...
Currently?
Currently, yeah. I put it at a 5. So it's not a ton of spend, but it's important for place-based out-of-home advertising, which is a very specific thing, usually advertising that you see like in shopping malls and arena. That form of outdoor advertising has taken a monumental hit. I just wrote about it in my recent out-of-home report. So this is actually an area of growth for, you know, a subset of outdoor advertising that has done pretty poorly. Soon, it will be 1/10 of total digital out-of-home advertising, which isn't anything to sneeze at. On the downside, though, you know, we're still talking about well under $1 billion, even at the end of our forecast period. We're talking about 1/4 of $1 billion this year. So, you know, there is certainly a ceiling on it. Mm-hmm. And to Max's point about thinking about not overdoing it, I don't know if I've ever encountered a more annoying ad in my life than going into a convenience store and wanting to grab a Gatorade. But instead of just seeing through the glass that has worked for, you know, since glass was invented, I see an ad, you know, advertising the types of drinks that might be in there. And I have to just keep opening cooler after cooler, letting the cold air breathe on me to see, do you have blue Gatorade? If you didn't have the ad, I would have known that.
I wonder if the ad revenues counterbalance the amount of money you lose just from people opening the cooler doors repeatedly.
Yeah, just say, screw it. You know what? I'll drink my own spit rather than having to see this ad again.
Ross is talking about like one example. So Cooler Screens, which partnered with Walgreens, Rachel was noting in her article, Walgreens actually rolled back its partnership with digital screens provider Cooler Screens because shoppers complained about this very thing that Ross is talking about. The tech made it difficult to find products, and also the concerns leadership had over the aesthetics as well. So you've got to do it right, but that does seem like a huge opportunity. One of the numbers that Rachel pointed out in her article, which I thought was fascinating, is the average in-store audience is 70% larger than its digital counterpart for top retailers, according to data from Placer.ai and Comscore. So Ross, you said 5 out of 10. Where can it get to?
Like 6.5. I don't think it's like going to take over the world.
Okay. All right, folks, so we've got time for the story of the week. Time now for the debate of the week. Today's segment, Make the Case. For our panel, Evelyn, Max and Ross present the for and against arguments for each of the following questions based on three news stories. Two contestants face off per question. Also, the following takes don't necessarily reflect the analyst's personal views. Their job is to just present the best case regardless and offer objective analysis.
True. We believe in nothing.
That's intense. So I sent these stories out to folks and they have to be the first one to reply and say, hey, I'd like to take this one or defend this argument. And it's first come, first serve. Ross replied all first and decided, Ross, you put your first and last name beside your stories. Do you think I was going to be like, which Ross?
Just in case, yeah, there's another Ross. You know, in kindergarten, there was two Ross Bs in my class of like 20. So
forget
never
that
know.
Guy. Okay.
All sounds right. Traumatic.
All right, folks. Let's crack on with the debate. Question one, Max against Evelyn. We're talking about whether Google could eat the internet. Justin Pott of The Atlantic writes that Google search is pivoting to generative AI, starting with an experimental tool in public beta called Search Generative Experience. He explains that instead of sending you off to other corners of the web, more search results appear within Google. Like ChatGPT, it pulls information from various sites, rewords it, and puts it on top of your search results, pushing down the links. Some searches will give you a normal list of links, but when the results are right at the top, there's often no point in ever leaving Google. Mr. Pott says this could be disastrous for the rest of the internet, since it relies on Google to send billions of visits to sites across the web every day. But the question is, will Google eat the internet? Max is presenting the case of Google will eat the internet. Make the case.
I think that you could argue that Google already has eaten the internet. It has, in no particular order, the largest email service provider, the largest search engine. It is the largest broker of digital advertisements. It owns the largest video platform. And I think you could also argue with a straight face that it has set the agenda for web publishing for a decade. I mean, there are so many curios across internet culture that are there basically only because of Google. The, kind of cottage industry of what time is the Super Bowl web posts and, 65 different websites posting the same Marvel movie trailer are all vestiges of, an internet that is controlled and sort of, shaped in Google's image. So I would argue that this is something that has already happened. Boink.
Max, no, that's it. Evelyn, Google won't eat the internet. Make the case.
So my argument is made by the last paragraph in this article. Tech critic Cory Doctorow said, when you've got a 90% market share, you cannot increase your bottom line by improving your product by definition. And if you can't grow by making the pie bigger, you grow by extracting more from it. And Pott ends the article with, this is a way for Google to strip mine the web, but strip mines, by their very nature, aren't sustainable. And this is all true. And AI arms race or not, it is not in Google's best interest to reduce the amount of high-quality human-generated content out there. If the internet becomes a sea of bots summarizing content written by other bots, its search product will be unusable. And if consumers don't use its search product, there's no reason for advertisers to keep spending on Google search, and Google loses its cash cow. If it wants to stick around for the foreseeable future, it can't afford to torpedo the long-tail publisher's business model. So it won't eat the internet. There's just too much money at stake.
All right. Very nice, folks. Let's move to question two. Max versus Ross. Has the rebrand from HBO to Max worked? Parent company Warner Brothers Discovery faces streaming growing pains in Q2, notes Insider Intelligence's Senior Director of Briefings Jeremy Goldman. He notes that Warner Brothers Discovery, WBD, including Max and Discovery Plus, which it owns, lost close to 2 million subscribers in the quarter, reducing the total count from 98 million to 96. That's the first subscriber decline since Max's launch. But the question is, has the rebrand from HBO to Max worked? Max is going to be arguing the rebrand from HBO to Max has worked. Make the case.
I think I am going to rely on the words of Warner Brothers Discovery's chief executive, David Zaslav, who pointed out that churn was lower than expected. He basically pointed to the decline in overall subscribers as the result of Discovery Max and HBO Max mushing together. And so to me, if it's all churn and the churn was lower than expected, then you must say that the rebrand was a success.
Ross, the rebrand from HBO to Max hasn't worked.
You can tell that I love this argument that I just made.
So they smushed together two streaming services that are supposed to give them synergy, but instead they lost 2 million subscribers and had their first subscriber loss ever. They also have higher, greater distribution than they've ever had. Well, not than they've ever had before, but than they had at HBO Max's late run because they're back on Amazon Prime Video channels. So they gave Amazon a cut of the revenue for that and some data, which most streaming services do. But my point being is that they've exhausted their distribution outlets. They put together their best assets and they still lost customers, which makes me think that it could have gone more smooth. Now, HBO, which is called Max now, cut a ton of shows over the last year. They've made their library much less attractive. They have reduced their losses, but don't be fooled by their PR statements about profitability. Taking down write-downs to make yourself look good for a quarter doesn't mean that you've laid a good foundation for your service.
Also, let's destroy all brand equity by eliminating both recognizable brands. Let's do it.
Ross.
But I'd replacing like it with something that is very attractive and very cool.
Max, Max, you should have said it worked because they named it after me. Like,
I was
name.
Saving that. I was saving that. To argue against myself, too, I mean, like, so they go through this big production of, you know, as Evelyn points out, like torpedoing both pretty recognizable brands and being like, it's all one thing now. This is all what we're doing. But then they announced, I think it was this week or maybe a week earlier, that they're going to have live sports on Max, but that's going to be under the Bleacher Report sub brand, which, you know, I frankly am amazed that they still care about because it seems like they had been sort of moving further and further away from Bleacher Report as a brand for years. So they haven't solved the branding problems at all. They've just, you know, created new ones.
If they called it Ross, I would have taken Max.
So yeah, to Max's point, WBD getting ready to launch a sports tier. Warner Brothers Discovery getting ready to launch a sports tier from its Max streaming service targeted to coincide with MLB playoffs. According to CNBC, the service will simulcast games from the MLB, NBA, NHL, and NCAA as well. Let's move to question three. And we've got Ross versus Evelyn. Is the US ad market starting to see green shoots? Stephen Lepetak and Rebecca Stewart of Adweek write that the ad industry hasn't shaken off the economic slump, but green shoots are sprouting. They point to recent Q2 earnings of Microsoft, Meta, and Google as reasons for optimism, but offer the counterweight of the global economy remaining flat over the last 3 years and high inflation continuing to bear down on the ad industry. The question is the US ad market actually starting to see green shoots? Ross is going to be arguing that the US ad market is starting to see green shoots. Make the case.
Well, you can find anecdotes for this point and as well as anecdotes for against it. But Meta had a fantastic quarter. You've also seen some growth, particularly in podcasting from Spotify and iHeart. CPG brands like Nestle and Pepsi have stated they're going to increase their ad spend. And a report by famed analyst Brian Weiser said that the ad industry had expanded in the second quarter at a greater rate than it did in the first quarter.
Evelyn, the US ad market isn't starting to see green shoots. Make the case.
To see green shoots, there has to be a pretty stark color differential. You know, maybe there's a bald spot in your yard, maybe it's crusty winter grass, but big picture, the US ad economy never stopped growing. It just grew a little bit slower than most had anticipated back in 2021. And it's a matter of expectations informing perception. 2021 was a wild year. The mid-pandemic advertising rebound was so massive and comparables were so favorable that it seemed like everything was coming up roses. But normalization is just a tough pill to swallow if the expectation is, or the goal is, indefinite growth. And as long as inflation stays where it is, we're not going to return to the lush rainforest of 2021, but we're not living in a barren wasteland either. You know, according to our estimates, the US ad market grew 7.9% last year. It'll grow 3.8% this year. So the yard is already green. So that's my argument.
Really went in on the gardening
analogy. You know, I'm convinced now. I agree with that one.
I was just going to say, for the record, I'm on Ross's side.
Unbelievable. They swapped sides at the end. Must have been very convincing. Very nice, folks. So two things for me. One, so US ad spend did fall 1.6% in June, according to the US Standard Media Index, after growing for the first time in 11 months in May. But given the steep drops ad spending has seen in the last 12 months, particularly the 12% drop last December, a 1.6% drop isn't too bad, all things considered, when you zoom out. And then also, Ross mentioned Meta doing pretty well in Q2, or really well in Q2. Recent digital ad company performance does suggest that things are improving to a certain extent. Google grew ad revenue 3% after two negative quarters. Meta was up 12%, up from 4% in Q1, and negative growth last year. Amazon saw ad revenues grow 22% up year over year. And these are a decent bellwether, considering the digital advertising accounts for 3 out of every 4 ad dollars in the US. All right, folks, very nice. That's what we've got time for the debate of the week. Very nice arguments, very nice arguments. We now end the show, of course, with dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Let's start with Ross.
Okay, so I got some data from the American Kennel Club and dog breeds. And in 2022,
Victoria is so excited.
Good to have someone else excited about this.
Me too.
So the top breed was the French Bulldog. And rounding out the top five was the Labrador Retriever, Golden Retriever, German Shepherd, and Poodle.
These the most popular poodle. Or most dogs?
Those are the most popular in 2022.
Okay. Popular in terms of number of people who have the dogs, or popular like we took a survey and these are the dogs people like the best?
You know what? Well, let's see here. Oh, it's based on the AKC's registration statistics. So the AKC.
Victoria knew that. Of course she did.
How should I phrase this? The AKC is like a dog's eugenics group, which so it makes me feel kind of skeezy about like the whole purebred movement in general. But they do track this stuff and you know, they're involved with stuff like Westminster. So as far as where you're going to get reliable dog data, I feel like they're probably as good as any, although there certainly be some gaps in people. I don't think I've ever reported any dog I've ever gotten to the AKC. So they're missing a lot. So take it for what it's worth. But in the bottom five, at 199, they did 199 dog breeds. Good to know there's so many. They had the English Foxhound. And then at 196, they had the American Foxhound. And I was kind of bummed by this because I think my big guy Cooper here, he's probably a mutt of various things, but he looks like a foxhound. And I didn't realize he was, you know, such an unpopular breed. So I guess like if I was into like being like a hipster dog owner, I could be like, oh, I got like a foxhound. Like no one else has a foxhound. But, you know,
I wondered why you asked him to leave the room before we did this show.
Well, now like, I brought him back, you know, so you could be here and hear this. And I just got to say that I think more people should have Coopers. They should be higher up on the list.
Favorite breeds real quick. Let's go around the horn. Victoria.
I'm partial to poodles.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Chester. Evelyn.
This is impossible.
Actually, I agree with everyone. I take my answer back. I just own
super
poodles.
Hard.
Yeah, okay, I own a pit bull. Love her to death. She's the sweetest thing on the planet. And I also grew up with golden retrievers and black labs. So, I just love dogs. Dogs are the best.
Max.
Yeah, I can't pick one, but I had a basset hound growing up, and I loved him so much. Yeah, I love them all though. Hard to pick just one.
Ross?
I really love retrievers, even though I have two hounds. So I should probably go with the hounds because they're looking at me.
Got to get them out of the room before you start saying these things. Jesus, Ross.
Yeah, they might start yelling.
The answer we were looking for is labradoodles. That's the answer we were looking for. Let's move to Evelyn.
Okay, so I have another like top list for you. This is the top most searched cereals. This is data from Google that they provided to.
Who's searching for cereal?
I don't know.
All right, just like in the store or on the internet?
No, on Google.
Okay.
Sure. I've done a lot of things, search for some strange stuff while I'm in an altered
Frosties?
State that I've never searched for cereal.
Sorry, go on, Nicole.
Well, this data is from Google. They provided it to Food and Wine. And so the Food and Wine kind of framed it as the most popular cereals, but I don't think that, you know, to your point, Marcus, who searches for cereals? Does that actually mean
Max,
that they're popular? So
I just said I don't.
So the top five here, actually, can anyone guess the top most searched for cereal?
Lucky Charms.
Cheerios.
Captain Crunch.
Good guesses. Frosties. Marcus, you're close. Cheerios is number two. Rice Krispies is number one. An interesting tidbit also is that Rice Krispies was the number one most searched for cereal in every single state in the United States, which, you know, the kind of idea that Food and Wine came up with that explains that is that people are searching for Rice Krispie treats recipes, perhaps. But the top five are kind of meh. Rice Krispies number one, Cheerios number two, Chex is number three, Special K is number four, and then number five, Lucky Charms. So that's where it starts to get fun. And this is a kind of a long list, but I'll also give you the bottom five that I've only heard of some of these. So number 26 is Kaboom. I don't even know what that is.
That sounds made up.
Yeah. So I don't even, I guess I would search for that too, just for try to understand like what is that cereal? 27 is Apple Jacks. 28, Raisin Bran.
Oh.
I think that's a just position, personally.
That's a shame.
29, Cocoa Pebbles. And 30 is Count Chocula. So there you
really?
Go.
Really?
Yep.
Really?
For folks who can't see Max, he's eating a bowl. right the second.
Discolored milk dribbling down my face. If Kaboom is not made up, and anyone who works at whatever made up company.
It's got a Wikipedia entry.
I googled it
while she was talking because I'd never heard of it either. And I feel like I'm pretty knowledgeable on cereal given like a few dozen cavities I've had.
Max, you're up, mate.
All right. So this week I saw a news item about Netflix quietly, maybe not so quietly, launching a games controller app in the Apple App Store. And it got me thinking, oh, that's interesting. It, you know, paves the way for them to, you know, allow their subscribers to play games on their televisions instead of their smartphones. And it got me thinking, just what is going on with their games business anyway? I mean, it's been in the wild for about 2 years. I think a lot of people scratched their heads when Netflix announced it and have sort of continued scratching their heads ever since, even though it seems like Netflix is, you know, making an earnest attempt to sort of build its brand and its library of games. And so I found some data from Apptopia that was shared with a mobile games website about a month ago. And Netflix has now got 20 games that have been downloaded over a million times. The most popular game has been downloaded about 6 million times. And, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at. That definitely shows real traction. It's harder to find reliable data on, you know, how much these games are being played, how sort of sticky and effective they are. But to give some added perspective, the number one downloaded game of last year was Subway Surfers, which was downloaded over 300 million times. So it's very hard to say that they, you know, have kind of turned this into an overnight success, but they are trying. And I thought that was a good
Netflix's most downloaded game, the 6 million?
Asphalt Extreme, which I've never even heard of. Okay. Too Hot to Handle is the number two, which I think is hilarious. They're making a second one, which I think is even stranger.
Thank goodness.
It also includes Mahjong Solitaire, which, get out of here, Netflix. I already have Mahjong and Solitaire.
Is the game that Victoria's sister, who also works at the company, thought was my favorite game. I said, do you want to guess my favorite game? She said, probably Solitaire.
Remains an extremely underrated burn.
Thanks, Jackie. That's brutal. All right, Very nice. I got one for you real quick. It's about the Barbie movie, which has emerged as the hit movie of the summer. The film stars Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, directed by Greta Gerwig, who also did Little Women and Lady Bird. So the recent Wall Street Journal piece from Rosie Ettenheim and Robbie Whelan noted the following. So three things about the film. So one, the Barbie movie has crossed the $1 billion mark globally. That would make it the fourth US motion picture directed by a woman to do so, according to Box Office Mojo. 52 movies in total have done that. The percentage of top films directed by women reached its highest level in 2020 at 15%. Only four films have performed better in the 4 weekdays after its debut. Only four films have performed better in the 4 weekdays after its debut, according to Comscore. Any guesses?
I got nothing.
Avatar?
Hey, is this four movies in the last year or four movies ever?
Oh, sorry, Avatar's not there. I don't know why I said yes.
The first Star Wars?
Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker are first and fourth. Spider-Man No Way Home, second. Avengers Endgame was third. And then finally, 2%, just 2%, I should probably say, of the 476 nominees for Best Director have been women. Just 2%. Catherine Bigelow was the first female to win Best Director for Hurt Locker. I haven't seen that. You guys seen that? That is one I wanted to...
Yeah, I've seen it.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, I need to get that.
If you feel like, you know, being unable to breathe for 2 hours is your idea of a good time.
Not really.
But it's very good.
Okay.
Just very stress-inducing.
V, you've watched it? It's good. All right. There it is. That's my weekend. That's what we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Evelyn.
Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you to Max.
Always a pleasure, Marcus.
Thank you to Ross.
See you later, Marcus.
Why does it take so long? Ross?
Just letting it
Were you
sit
thinking
in
about,
there.
I don't know whether I want to thank you back. All right, fine. Thanks to Victoria, who edits the show. James Cobby edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone listening. You can head to BehindTheNumbers_podcast for outtakes. We'll see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, a new marketing podcast made possible by Awin. Happy weekends.
I don't know if I told you this. Movie theater popcorn doesn't have real butter. It's usually plant oil, so I can eat it. And oh boy, did I.
She's back.
Went way overboard on the popcorn.
So good. You only get the popcorn.
She's back.
You smuggle in drinks, unless you're a fountain soda aficionado, which I can confirm that I am. You usually smuggle in drinks, chocolate, sour candies. My mom used to smuggle in like containers of watermelon in the summer.
Nice.
Who's bringing Tupperware?
Mess.
Bringing Tupperware?
And Grace.
Genius.
That's pretty amazing.